that was given by Peter Kaufman of the Party of Socialism and Liberation on Charlottesville and the anti-fascist struggle. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that now.
We've all been seeing and participating in anti-fascist actions ever since the Nazis, the KKK, and other white supremacists submerged themselves within the Trump campaign back in 2016 in an attempt to catapult their ideology out of the shadows and into the mainstream. But the degree of organization and coordination of the right and the murder of Heather Heyer and wounding of dozens who bravely stood up to one of the largest rallies of these fascists in decades marks a significant turning point in the struggle against fascism. White supremacist terrorism is nothing new, not in the history of the US, which is founded on white supremacist terrorism, nor in all the years since, where the country thrives and is rescued by alternating waves of white supremacist terror aimed at parts of our population at home, and the terror of the state founded on white supremacy aimed at nations who simply want to determine their own existence abroad. This new wave of Nazi and Klan organizing and the so-called alt-right came into fruition during Obama and grew tremendously through those years by fomenting racist conspiracy theories, engaging in mock lynchings of the president, among other racist speech and mobilization within the ranks of the Koch-funded Tea Party. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors hate organizations in the U.S., found that there was a tenfold increase in membership in these white supremacist groups and a tenfold increase in the variety of them during the Obama administration. And this map here shows, this is from 2016, the 917 hate organizations in the U.S. We, of course, have some disagreement with the Southern Poverty Law Center. We don't think that black nationalist organizations are hate groups, which are included in some of this, but the overwhelming majority, of course, about 750 or more are the actual white supremacist terrorists that we're talking about of different varieties. And in the first month from his election, there was 1,100 hate crimes committed. California was at the top with about 130 hate crimes in that first month. So we can see what the election of Donald Trump has done and how the organic connection between these fascists and Trump's rhetoric and agenda has created this situation. And to be clear, the so-called alt-right are really just Nazis and Klansmen without the spine to admit who they really are. They hide behind this benign-sounding label so that they can smile and shake hands with the ordinary worker or middle-class white person in order to recruit them to their no less insane arguments about creating an ethno-state where whites reign as dictators of society. Or worse, adding spinelessness to their spinelessness, making outrageous claims about a so-called white genocide, while everyone else with half a brain or any heart has been forced to watch the wanton murder of black youth in daily videos in every corner of the country with disgust and disdain for this rotten system. These are the types of people who have been engaging in unspeakable and disgusting racist acts of murder, including the murders of Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Renisha McBride, Dia Nasur and Razan of Chapel Hill, and the elders and women of the Charleston Massacre, Cynthia Graham Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lee Lance, DePayne Middleton, Clementa Pinckney, Tywanza Sanders, Daniel Simmons, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, and Myra Thompson. Or the most recent, the anti-racist heroes in Portland, Ricky John Best, and Tyleson Namke Meche, who were killed defending two Muslim women under attack from a white supremacist. There are countless other victims of all walks of life in the last few years of these individual acts of terror by white supremacists and fascists. But what changed in the wake of the Trump campaign was a move toward more overt, organized and united attempts to build a fascist movement that would adopt open white supremacist rhetoric, or at the very least, hardly veiled dog whistles, what my comrade Eugene actually calls a dog bullhorn now, to create more than a climate of white supremacist terror, but a fact of white supremacist power on the streets to carry out their violence. The stabbings in Anaheim, the shooting of Black Lives Matter protesters in Minneapolis, the immense brawl in Sacramento led by Nazi skinheads, the Klan rallies throughout the South, culminated in the action that took place on Saturday in Charlottesville, where a new degree of unity between fascist organizations and coordinated violence was seen. We are still learning about everything that took place in Charlottesville, and we will continue to learn more as more videos and eyewitness accounts come out. But here are just a few of the main takeaways factually that I've been able to gather for tonight's meeting. The fascists gloated about a so-called surprise event taking place on Friday night. And Spencer alerted the local media to go to the University of Virginia around 9 p.m. This is Richard Spencer, the notorious fascist who was thankfully punched at one point. Some anti-fascists got wind of the planned torchlit march, much like the one that Spencer led in Charlottesville some months ago, through the campus. Spencer and the other neo-Nazi groups marched on the school's central square, chanting blood and soil. This is an old Nazi slogan that referred to the blood of the master race and the soil which only belonged to them. And you, or alternatively Jews, will not replace us. Upon reaching the Jefferson statue at the center of the school, they began beating, with torches and sticks, the several dozen anti-fascist protesters assembled there, while shouting, "Die, commie," and racial slurs. One of the Black Lives Matter activists had lighter fluid poured on them, but luckily wasn't burnt. After beating the students, the neo-Nazis continued to march to a nearby church where an anti-fascist meeting had been organized by clergy. They had gathered there for an event to hear from the local leaders and others, including Cornel West. The church was being secured by a group of redneck revolt volunteers who were armed with shotguns, pistols, and long rifles, as well as a mass contingent of anti-fascists. As the neo-Nazis approached, the anti-fascists engaged them in a brawl, stopping them short of reaching the church, where they no doubt had planned to attack as they had done to the students. Redneck Revolt assisted in evacuating the attendees of the church as the brawl ensued. Cornel West went on to say that at multiple points throughout the weekend, it was these brave people who were willing to engage the fascists, confront them directly, that saved them. The fascists included the Klan, the National Socialist Movement, American Vanguard, Traditional Workers' Party, KECS, League of the South, Proud Boys, Identity Europa, and many others, showing a degree of unity amongst the anti-Semitic sections of the broader fascist milieu. The so-called Unite the Right rally included a plethora of infamous fascist leaders who did the work to organize it, including Jason Kessler, Richard Spencer, Baked Alaska, Based Stickman, Nathan D'Amigo, Matthew Heinbach, even David Duke, and Chris Cantwell, who we'll talk a little bit more about later. These white supremacists came far more materially prepared to fight than the anti-racist counter-protesters. And this was something that was noticed by everybody. Each fascist group had contingents of men armed with riot shields, helmets, body armor, bludgeons, pepper spray, flares, and even tear gas. In addition, the militia, who primarily functioned to defend the fascists, were openly carrying an assortment of firearms, including assault rifles. The fascists operated in a fashion that demonstrated they have been practicing maneuvers intended to be deployed in these street battles, with spotters calling out commands from behind fortified lines. This isn't surprising, as the development of their tactics can be seen from Sacramento and Berkeley up to now. By the time the fascists began arriving for their rally sometime around 10 a.m., there were already hundreds and soon to be thousands of counter-protesters surrounding Emancipation Park, where the rally was set to take place. The police only blocked off two sides of the park and claimed that the fascists had backed out of a plan to escort them into the park from that one particular direction. Instead, violently plowing through counter-protesters at different points to reach the park. One side of the park was left without any police presence at all. And for several hours, wave after wave of fascists would attempt to leave the park in this direction, fighting the anti-fascists in continuous melee and constantly being beaten back into the park by the anti-fascists. Projectiles were thrown back and forth through that few hours, and by 11:30-ish in the morning, the assembly was declared unlawful, and a state of emergency declared, as anti-fascists had managed to begin pushing into the park. Folks were instructed that they would not be permitted in Emancipation Park or McIntyre Park, where fascists were attempting to regroup after taking beatings from the anti-fascists, or on the streets of downtown Charlottesville. You were to be arrested if you were really anywhere. The police cleared the park of fascists, pushing them back in the direction they had come from, toward the crowd of anti-fascist protesters, exacerbating the ongoing clashes. During this time, most of the so-called alt-right groups, including Spencer himself, went toe-to-toe with the police, fighting them and attempting to beat them back. But of course, not one of these people was arrested for assaulting a police officer. Whether rumor or fact, it's not totally clear, but the plan of the fascists seemed to have been spread through the counter-protesters, and they thought that they would regroup at McIntyre Park and then march on a predominantly black housing project in Charlottesville. Counter-protesters crowded into downtown streets to prepare to block the fascists from marching on the housing project and to celebrate their victory, as thousands of them had prevented the rally from going forward and not a single fascist spoke that day. As you can see, there were hundreds, thousands of protesters who actually prevented them from getting a platform, got the demonstration shut down. This is a big victory. And around this time, witnesses, including a photographer for the local paper, spotted a Dodge Challenger turning a corner to face the anti-racist protesters who were reveling in their victory. This photographer actually mentioned that he witnessed the Challenger backing up slowly. He thought that he was going to be leaving the area. But that's when this white supremacist terrorist, who had marched with American Vanguard, an organization which quickly denied that he's a member, but we're fairly certain he is since he was wearing their uniform, slowly reversed the car and then drove full speed into the crowd, wounding up to 19 people and killing Heather Heyer. The police deployed a heavily armored vehicle and forces to the scene of this terrorist attack rather than chasing him down, and began policing the folks there, including putting a stop to life-saving CPR that was being given to Heather Heyer by anti-fascist street medics. There is no guaranteeing that this treatment would have saved Heather's life, but the decision of the police to interfere with her medical treatment, if she stood any chance at that time, ensured she would die. The next day, notorious white supremacist Jason Kessler, who organized the Unite the Right rally, attempted to host a press conference where he attempted to place blame squarely on the shoulders of the left and to play as though the white man is the quintessential victim and on the brink of extinction, or some other nonsense. He also gave us some, you know, false words about denouncing the violence. But let's go ahead and show what happened to Jason Kessler.
And people resorting to violence. Yesterday,
off, Jason.
Day murder now. Day for murder now.
Day
for murder. Invited.
I'll be in Washington.
Thank you.
There's another raw footage angle where you get to see the terror in his face a lot more as he's running away, which is greatly appreciated. But you can see that when the working class gets together, these fascists don't stand a chance, right?
Right. Yeah.
Thank you. When they get together and they commit themselves to bold action, right? He was not allowed to speak. Not because there's the government or anyone else telling him he can't speak, but because we say he can't speak. Especially not after murdering somebody. So that was a powerful moment in the wake of this tragedy that I wanted to share. Now, in nearly every national tragedy, such as this one, the government makes some feigned semblance of condolence to those who are victimized by hate, racist police terror, or whatever it may be, and calls for unity and prayers abound. It's always just a gesture, of course, and it's usually not intended with very much real sentiment. But Trump is different. Trump didn't go to Heather Heyer's memorial service, or even send a delegate from the administration, or even contact her mother to express any regret over the racism and open white supremacy he has stoked for 2 years that led to her murder. Trump is truly a sociopath and a monster, and will be remembered as one of the worst criminals to ever take up residence in that criminal building. In his first off-the-cuff statement, he claimed that there was violence and wrongdoing on many sides, putting an equal sign between the terrorism of the fascists on the one hand and the defensive acts and bravery of the anti-fascists on the other, who truly saved lives. There can be nothing more incredulous or stupid than trying to compare the planned and coordinated violence of forces who hope for the ethnic cleansing of the U.S. and the establishment of a white ethnostate by their very own declaration with those who are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to stand in the way of that genocidal program of fascism. But not only that, it was plain for anyone to see that the violence was from the right, and that the act of terror had been carried out by the white supremacists. So the public raged at Trump for his statements, so much so that someone forced him to read a prepared statement on Monday that condemned the KKK, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, and other hate groups. But the statement was too little and too late, and it was clearly not his own. Just a day or two later, he doubled down in a press conference about infrastructure, going on a long tirade that towed the line of the fascists who were there that day, that they had somehow been denied their right to speak, that their rights were violated, that they were victims of violence in equal measure at the hands of the so-called alt-left, that he claimed came charging at the alt-right, and that, you know, he didn't go this far, but the line coming from the fascists is that this terrorist was terrified himself and acted in self-defense, was scared and tried to run away. But we know the truth. He intended to murder those people, just like everyone else that came there that day to participate in that rally. There's no mistaking that. And not being satisfied with a meltdown during this press conference, and probably doing some deep thinking afterward about his own magnificence, he decided to take to Twitter and tell us that it's just so very sad that Confederate monuments were coming down across the country. Of course, we don't care about Confederate monuments because they're not monuments to anything that matters to us in the working class. During the week, a slew of corporations dropped any support for Trump, including almighty Walmart. And opportunistic politicians came out of the woodwork to condemn Trump, including figures like Marco Rubio out of the wood... and Mitt Romney. Romney said, no, not the same. One side is racist, bigoted, Nazi. The other side opposes racism and bigotry. Morally different universes. And this is coming from, like, really someone who's sort of an arch-racist himself, right? And Romney doesn't care about anybody. He doesn't care about the people of other countries. He doesn't care about women or LGBTQ people. He's just as much of a bigot. But this was a moment, right? Because anyone who takes a swipe at the sinking ship of Trump is positioning themselves for some kind of political gain later. And today, we got the news that the white supremacist Steve Bannon is officially out of the White House, not just out of his position, likely motivated by people around Trump rather than Trump himself. You know, they want to put a stop to this chaos in the administration, chaos in the empire. They want something that's more controlled. But in any case, who is to blame for this after all? First and foremost, the fascists. If anyone needs to give up on violence and organizing and go home and eat sheets of cake, it's them. Their shrill cries about the white male dying out are nothing that the rest of us in society care about. Because we see plainly that, in fact, our society gives all of the extra privileges to white males. Whether we're talking about completing education, owning a home, owning their own property, gainful employment, and avoiding the pitfalls of the police, courts, and prison. Secondly, the blame falls on the Charlottesville PD and Virginia State Police, who stood idly by as white supremacists had free rein, while better equipped weapons to carry out their violence against counter-protesters. No measure was taken by them to slow down the growing pace of violence that day, and they even pushed the Nazis and Klansmen into the anti-fascist crowd of thousands, further stoking the flames of racist violence. If they had any sense at all, or any will to care, then they would have understood that the violence of Friday night would mean violence in the streets on Saturday. We all knew it. We all went to bed knowing it. It isn't a verified claim, but for those of us with a sense of the history of struggle against fascism in the U.S., or have paid attention to recent news stories, there are plenty of Klansmen and Nazis in those blue uniforms. They don't scream for that when you become an officer. There are also plenty of examples in history of the police working in direct cahoots with the white supremacists. So while this may not be confirmed, it certainly looks like it. They claimed they were too ill-equipped to deal with the massive outpouring of fascists and anti-fascists. The police are turning this into an argument for more weapons of war and more police. This is an argument that is repeated wherever the fascists go and lead disruptive violent rallies. But we know that these are blatant lies intended to strengthen the bottom line of the police department, because when the native people came out and their allies, not to commit acts of racist terrorism, but to save the Missouri River, their sacred land, and their sovereignty, they were hit with all the force that the state had to offer. Police were imported from around the country, and every possible weapon of war was made available to suppress them. They shot them with rubber bullets and blasted them with water cannons in freezing weather. When the people of Ferguson, a destitute black suburb of St. Louis that gets the lion's share of its city funds from ticketing and policing black people, decided to rise up against the constant police harassment and terror and the murder of Mike Brown, no shortage of weapons, armor, or police were made available. No police anywhere in this country have a problem with equipment. All police departments, though, have a problem with institutionalized racism. The righteous causes of the working class and oppressed are met with the utmost brutality, while the brutality of white supremacists is given a free pass. This wasn't only signaled by the police involved, but also our president's disgusting statements. When he indicted the so-called alt-left, we have to understand what this meant for those of us who are revolutionaries, communists, anarchists, etc. The term, originating amongst the failed liberals who desperately searched for someone to blame besides themselves for Hillary's embarrassing loss to the most embarrassing politician in U.S. history. They used the term to attack Sanders folks, social democrats, greens, communists, anyone who refused to play along with their lesser evil game. But since then, it was picked up by fascist bloggers and now by the president in the hopes of alienating the revolutionary forces from the masses of people who have been moving closer and closer to us every year. This is why they are targeting leftists who fought back in Sacramento and giving absurd charges and sentencing to the anarchists that protested in D.C. This is why the Department of Justice, under Klansman Jeff Sessions, have illegally demanded the IP addresses of 1.3 million people who just happened to visit the Disrupt J20 website, which the web host is fighting back against in the courts. They want to target us for repression while giving the white supremacists a pass. And as they close in on us, they open up the floodgate of white supremacy. Trump has eliminated white supremacist groups from the slew of organizations targeted by the state for monitoring. Trump cut all funding to a government-supported program that helped employ ex-Nazis and ex-Klansmen in their efforts to counter-recruit people away from these organizations and rehabilitate them to prepare them for life after hate. In every possible way, the state has shown, from the very top levels to the very bottom, that it finds the growing fascist movement to be at the very least acceptable. For now. And laws are being passed across the country that target protesters. It's legal to run people over in some states now because of this growing disdain for the social movements that are threatening the class system and threatening the rule of Wall Street and the Pentagon and the people who have been ruling over us ever since this country was founded. So whenever someone tries to call you all left, make sure you tell them that the word is meaningless and that you're proud to be a communist or a revolutionary. We don't have anything to hide. We don't have anything to be ashamed of. We stand on the shoulders of those who defeated fascism the first time. It raised its ugly head, and we will be the ones that beat them back today. Start talking about how the movement unfolded, but before I do that, I just want to talk about a basic understanding of what fascism is. It's something that comes about at a time of crisis in the capitalist system, when the capitalist system is on its dying throes, which we see today. Half of the country doesn't even have a savings. The next capitalist crisis is going to ruin huge sectors of the working class, and they're stripping every last thing that we fought for and won, including healthcare. They're getting rid of all the environmental regulations. Everything that they're doing is in a desperate attempt to squeeze out just a little bit of profit. And on the other hand, beefing up the militarization of police, using more and more repressive tactics against movements here in the U.S. All of this stuff is about trying to stabilize the system. Elections don't work anymore. The vast majority, millions of people, saw in 2016 that we don't live in a democracy. We live in a dictatorship of the rich. And they can't backpedal from that anymore because we're conscious of it and we're moving ahead. And as they continue to have this ongoing crisis, they have to rely on someone else, right? The 99 to 1%, that's a real variable there. Those are real numbers. We are the vast majority of people. The billionaires, the bankers, the Pentagon generals, they are the minority. And so they can't possibly defend themselves on their own when we start waking up and fighting back. And so in those moments of crisis, they turn to what we call the petty bourgeoisie, or the upper middle class, the small owners of businesses, small-time landlords and slumlords, some of the professional classes who are well-paid. These are the kinds of people that they try to recruit into these fascist movements, along with people who are destitute, right, and can be pulled in to this false ideology of fascism. And so what's happening right now is really important, because the fascists are battling to recruit those forces with them. But those forces in society don't necessarily believe in fascism or have to. We have a duty to struggle over those forces in society as well and win them to our side against fascism. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that more as we go, but let's go ahead and pull up that third.
Thank you.
the point on tactics. If anyone ever does this, cover your face. In the aftermath of this tragedy, the movement to tear down all the Confederate monuments and other racist monuments around the country has been given a burst of energy. In Durham, North Carolina, as you just saw, folks got together and tore down a Confederate monument on their own. Fearing the same fate of monuments here in Los Angeles, Baltimore, and half a dozen other cities, they're tearing them down in the dark of night now to lay to rest any brewing controversy over the racist monuments and try to preemptively prevent these movements from exploding in their own cities. And this righteous movement will surely continue to score victories across the country. And we should add that, yes, Trump, we do want to slide down that slippery slope from tearing down Confederate generals and colonizers who slaughtered natives to the slave-owning founding fathers themselves who have no business being praised. We will tear down the Washingtons and Jeffersons, and we will replace them with John Browns, Harriet Tubmans, and Geronimos. We call for all the charges being brought against these activists to be dropped immediately. And while we want to tear down every last monument to white supremacy, we also want to tear down white supremacy itself and capitalism. We don't militantly resist fascism because we don't like them or because we have a love for violence against our foes or a different point of view and we can't come together and get along. But because their political program, if implemented, would mean the mass murder of millions of Black, Brown, Native, LGBTQ, Asian, Muslim, Jews, union workers, and anyone who espouses leftist views such as our own. This is why any bold action taken by anti-fascists against the white supremacists, even preemptive action, is not an attack, but instead is self-defense of the communities who would be decimated by fascist empowerment. We study the history of fascism and anti-fascism to guide our analysis today. What took place in Charlottesville was an example of the classic tactics and strategy of fascism that brought them to power in Italy and Germany. Highly organized, trained paramilitary squadrons would converge on small cities and localities to carry out mass terrorism and violence against those they hoped to repress, especially leftists and other targeted sectors of society. They implemented widespread targeting of individuals for intimidation or assassination. A takeover of a town would be followed by mass recruitment to their toxic ideology, parties, and paramilitary groups, and then repeated once again in another nearby town. This would be repeated until resistance to their control of public spaces waned, and until they had grown wide enough base to begin to threaten to take central power away from the existing state institutions themselves. This is why we can't afford to listen to the liberal line of thought that argues that the best way to stop them is to ignore them. If we ignore them, they will continue to grow. Because by ignoring them, we are ignoring the suffering they inflict on other people in some far-off town or city, and each time they are allowed to get away with it, we normalize their behaviors and more and more. This is largely what led to their empowerment in the first place in the 20s and 30s. So no, Tina Fey, we aren't going to go home and eat cake. We're going to get united, prepared, and we're going to smash these fascists so they never threaten another town again. We also can't acquiesce to the position of some folks who have been on the front lines in fighting fascism, and we do commend them for their bravery and have respect for them in that regard, but whose theory that unilateral and individualist and poorly organized forms of asymmetrical violence can stop the fascists on its own. The left, communists, and anarchists, and other radicals cannot afford to suffer the immense losses that are certain if we try to substitute ourselves for the mobilized force of the working class as a whole. These are two lines we have to oppose, refraining from direct confrontation on the one hand, and direct confrontation with poor organization on the other. We need to strike a balance, mobilizing as much of the working class as we can to come out each and every time, and then, once they are ruthlessly outnumbered, taking as bold as action as necessary to stop them. We already outnumber them, and they know it. For them to get the results they did in Charlottesville, it took a colossal effort and work to mobilize fascists from every corner of the country. They are by themselves on their block. They are by themselves in their workplace. They are by themselves stuck in traffic. They are by themselves at the supermarket. They are outnumbered in every respect right now, in every corner of society, and we can keep it that way by out-organizing them and showing them what potential price they will pay for trying to organize a fascist movement in earnest. We can already see them losing their bearings. They're being fired from their jobs. They're being publicly disowned by their families. They're being chased out of the small towns they came from, told they can't live there anymore. There were even fascists who, on the day of, tore off their terrible Chad uniforms. No offense to the anti-fascist Chads of the world. And begged for mercy. And that they weren't really Nazis. They were just there for fun. Even Cantwell was crying his crocodile tears now that he's facing potential arrest and prosecution. As I said before, these people are the lowest cowards. Their movement and their acts of terror are akin to the tantrum of a child, because they are powerless if we come together and make them powerless, as the heroes in Charlottesville did. The murder, and yes, martyrdom, of Heather Heyer, along with the footage of this heinous terrorist attack and other violence, has sparked a raging prairie fire across the U.S., as tens of thousands of people have poured into the streets in every major city across the country from all walks of life. In Southern California, I've counted already nearly 15 anti-fascist actions that have taken place or will take place this weekend. In fact, one of the largest rallies yet will take place tomorrow in Venice Beach, where a planned neo-Nazi rally was forced to be postponed because the masses of people decided to attend in the thousands to oppose their bigoted march on Google, decrying their diversity policies as anti-white male. These cowards had the audacity to put out a sniveling statement of defeat that claimed that so-called alt-left terrorists were planning to, quote, ram their car into their so-called peaceful march. Yeah, they really went there. We will be there. And we hope all of you will join us in celebrating a people's victory over fascism this weekend. Even comrades in Orange County have managed to outnumber them nearly 10-1 in an upcoming action on Sunday in Laguna Beach. Our work isn't done with the fascists, comrades, and in many ways we are only beginning. They thought the weeks following Charlottesville would be their time to rally around the country in victory, but everywhere they are suffering defeats now, being met with stiff resistance, canceling their events, and watching their loser heroes toppled and smashed before their eyes. They are planning a nationwide march in D.C. on September 16th that will no doubt also be met with powerful resistance by the people there, because what they did in Charlottesville was waken the sleeping giant of the working class, which they stand no chance against. We hope all of you here will join us in the weeks, months, and years to come, no matter what it takes, no matter how long it takes, to bury this new wave of fascism once and for all. Thank you.
Classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit. I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts. Packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes. I make fascists crap their pants, stanzas, cure cultural cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum. Getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis. My word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons, and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, give back like church hats or get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction. Flip the shit just like a brick throne. Dethrone kings, bring the treason. My tone rock like keyboards are pop. Hip hop hotter than a rocket shot. I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big dog. Teach it to flee from the flock, walk off. Switch shit, hit my target. Drop like bombs in the form of carpets. I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Take it to back. Boom bap. Boom bap.
Boom bap. Original rap.
I'm talking true path. Master the craft. The pupil, the prof. Keep dropping math. Boom bap. Blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap. Original rap.
This is Michael Parenti, and welcome to Real History, a series of talks by me on different historical subjects that are relevant for understanding today's realities. Most people are never exposed to real history. In school, we usually don't read history, we read history textbooks, and mainstream ones at that, which avoid underlying realities, and ones that propagate myths that serve the powers that be. Myths that some of us find harmful to the truth and to democracy. So this is real history. This particular segment is entitled The Functions of Fascism. Fascism is a name that was given to the political movement that arose in Italy under the leadership of Benito Mussolini, who ruled that country from 1922 to 1943. Nazism, a similar movement led by Adolf Hitler, was Germany's dictator from 1933 to 45. It's considered by most observers to be a variant of fascism, as to a lesser degree is the militaristic government that controlled Japan from 1940 to 45, and the Falangist movement led by Francisco Franco in Spain, when the fascists there, with the military aid, by the way, of the Italian and Nazi fascists, took over after a protracted civil war. There are similar fascist or self-avowed fascist movements, but less successful ones arose in Eastern Europe and in Great Britain, the United States, France, and other Western industrial nations movements. Some of them also came to power. We might recall today, when the press is full of news about how Bulgaria or Romania or Hungary or Lithuania are returning, or Poland are returning to their democratic roots by overthrowing communism, we might recall that they weren't democratic before communism came in. They were fascist. In fact, several of those countries, with the exception of Poland, were open allies of the Nazis. They were Nazi fascist allies. Now, like with a lot of terms like liberalism, democracy, socialism, communism, no single definition of fascism maybe will satisfy everybody. And with fascism, there's a really special problem, because it's a beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. And the reactionary class politics are the part of fascism that our establishment historians, almost never talk about. Hitler's party, for instance, was called the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP, or Nazis. It's a very left-sounding name, National Socialist German Workers, and it was designed to win broad support among working people, even while the Nazis were destroying working-class organizations. In other words, fascism, the original Italian and German variations of fascism, was a political phenomenon that made a revolutionary appeal without making a revolution. It promised to solve the ills of the many while, in fact, protecting the special interests of the few with violence and terror. And it propagated a new political consciousness, a new order, a new nation to serve the same old capitalist system. Let me run down a couple of the major characteristics of the fascist ideology. First, there's a glorification of the leadership cult. The commitment to an absolutist and supreme leader, all-knowing, all-guiding. The Führerprinzip, as it's called. The Führer principle. The leader principle, I should say. Second, there's a glorification of the nation state as an end in itself, as an entity unto itself, an absolute component to which the individual is subsumed. Everything in the state, everything for the state, nothing outside of the state. That was Mussolini's dictum, and it was Hitler's also. In fact, with Hitler, Rudolf Hess once said, Adolf Hitler is Germany, Germany is Adolf Hitler, therefore combining both the leadership cult and the state cult in one. Third, there was a glorification of military conquest and jingoism, the glory of that the state is vitalized by subduing, conquering, taking other people, enslaving them, you increase your own power and your own glory. Fourth, there was the propagation of a folk mysticism, a xenophobia and a racism. The Nazi slogan was Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. Also, as a other side of the folk mysticism and this blood cult of the special blood, the special legacy, the atavistic wonders of our particular people, was a xenophobia, a hatred and a racism, a hatred of other peoples, other nationalities. With the Nazis and with most other Eastern European fascists, it was anti-Semitism. The Jew was seen as the perpetrator of all that was ill in society. The trade unionists, they were Jews. The communists, so forth and so on. And behind them stood this wicked, alien-blooded creature who would undermine our state. Fifth, there was an opposition, both in Italian fascism and in German Nazism, an opposition to socialism, to communism, to anarchism, and to all left egalitarian class movements and doctrines, along with opposition to trade unions, opposition to labor parties, opposition to other working class political organizations. Of these various characteristics of Nazism, 1, 2, 3, 4 are often talked about by established historians and mainstream historians. That last one, though, opposition to labor unions, opposition to working class parties, opposition to socialism and such, that one is never talked about by Western writers, especially American writers. The historians and the political scientists and the journalists who treat the subject of fascism usually write from a centrist ideological perspective, from the political center of the spectrum, which means they usually ignore the link between fascism and capitalism, just as they tend to ignore the entire subject of capitalism itself when there's something unfavorable to say about it. Instead, they dwell on the more phantasmic components of fascist ideology, the nihilistic revolt against Western rationalism and individuality, the irrational appeals to mass submission to a leader and all that. And fascism was those things, but along with its irrational appeals, it had rational functions. It was a rational instrument for class domination and for the preservation of the existing capitalist system. After World War I, Italy had a parliamentary government that seemed really incapable of solving the country's economic crises. Profits were declining, banks were failing, unemployment was rising. So to ensure profits, the big industrial giants and the big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with tariff protections along with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this, the population would have to be taxed more heavily, their wages rolled back, and social welfare expenditures drastically cut. It sounds like Reaganism. Well, it is, even more extremely so. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications. And through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications. And through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands. They often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. And even in the face of this worsening economic crisis, they were able to mount a troublesome defense of their standard of living. I mean, troublesome for those who own the land, the labor, and the capital, and the money in the banks, and the farms, and the factories. So the only solution really was to smash the worker and peasant organizations, in effect destroying all political and civil liberties, including the right to organize, agitate, and propagandize. The state would have to be more authoritarian and more firmly subservient to the interests of capital. Mussolini and his black shirts were around right after World War I, and for about 3 or 4 years, the big landowners and industrialists used their fascist goon squads, gave them money and gave them arms, and used them as kind of strike breakers, anti-labor militias. They styled themselves the United Front Against Bolshevism. In 1922, the big capital interests in Italy decided to go for the whole thing. Representatives of the Federation of Industry and the Federation of Agriculture, which was a agribusiness firm, and representatives of the National Banking Association, they all met together, and they met with Mussolini, and they planned the fascist march on Rome. Mussolini sat there and planned that with the leading capitalists of Italy. By the way, this is almost never mentioned in the accounts about the March on Rome. These big capitalists contributed 20 million lira toward that undertaking. In the words of Senator Ettore Conti, himself a very loyal representative of the moneyed interests, quote, "Mussolini was the candidate of the plutocracy, that is, of the wealthy, and the business associations." A very similar pattern, by the way, of coordination and compliance existed between in Germany also, less than a decade later. German workers and farm laborers in the period following World War I under the Weimar Republic won some important economic concessions. They won an 8-hour day, they won unemployment insurance, they were able to elect shop committees, and they won the right to unionize. And again, during the 1920s, these paramilitary right-wing gangs, most notably Hitler's brown shirts, stormtroopers, were subsidized by business in a limited way and kept as a kind of reserve army, what Gourin called the bodyguard of capitalism. And their job again was to strike, break, and to harass, organize workers, and to beat up socialists and communists and such. The nearly total collapse of the German economy in 1929-30 presented the owning class with a momentous crisis. They had very big capital investments, and these left them with very high fixed costs that had to be met even as their plants lay idle. Only massive state aid could revive their profits. Wages and social welfare, human service expenditures had to be cut. Union contracts had to be abrogated. In fact, human contracts had to be abrogated too. Business would need new subsidies and tax exemptions. The crisis in agriculture was equally severe, and the large landed proprietors, Junker class, demanded even higher subsidies, heavier duties on foreign agricultural imports, and an end to farm unions. These unions were holding wages up, and when wages were being sustained, you cut into profits. So by 1930, most of the influential landowners and big industrialists and bankers, especially the industrialists in steel, coal, and mining, had concluded that the Weimar Republic no longer served their interests, and no longer could protect their class, that it was too accommodating to the working class and to certain sectors of light industry. So they greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and they propelled the Nazi Party onto the national stage. By 1930, most of the great industrialists and bankers were underwriting the Nazi Party. And what happened in 1930 with this injection of hundreds of millions of marks is that Hitler was able to catapult his party onto the national scene. It went from a cult of brown shirt thugs to a national party mobilized. In the election of 1930, the Nazi Party gained 107 seats in the Reichstag. And Hitler, later on, evoking the memory of what he called that astonishing campaign, told his listeners to think of, quote, what it means when 1,000 speakers, each has a car at his disposal and can hold in a year 100,000 meetings. And in 1931 and 32, the subsidies from the big industrialists continued to grain in ever more abundantly. So the Nazis were projected onto the national stage, and they gained an ever larger presence in the Reichstag. Neither in Italy nor in Germany was revolution really something that was in the offing. I mean, it wasn't a real threat. The left was never strong enough to take state power in either of those countries. So the threat wasn't really from the left. The bourgeoisie resorted to fascism less in response to the disturbances in the street and more in response to the disturbances in their own economic system. The threat wasn't from the left. The threat was from their own economic systems and its contradictions, and the fact that democratic forces had developed enough democratic strength to resist the austerity and the rollback that the capitalists tried to impose to maintain their levels of profit. The sickness that these capitalists tried to banish was from within, not from without. The Italian and German monopolists, the big cartels, also had a direct interest in an expansionist military regime. They wanted a big rebuilding of the military, one that would, one, compensate, first of all, would compensate for the decline in investment opportunities with huge armament contracts and related public works. In other words, this industrial and financial class wanted a large defense budget, as we would call it, because it was a source of capital investment and enormous capital profits. Does that sound familiar? Two, they wanted to embark on an aggressive foreign policy to open new markets for export and investment, thereby gaining a more equal footing with French and English competitors. So the fascists really became a very valuable ally against the capitalists' two worst enemies. The capitalists' two worst enemies are, first, the workers in their own country, and the capitalists of foreign countries. And the genuineness, by the way, of fascism's hatred of workers and foreigners was never open to doubt, so they fit in quite snugly. Now, I don't mean to say that all the big industrialists and financiers supported fascism with equal fervor. Some, like Tyson, were early and enthusiastic backers of Hitler. The aged Emil Kerdorf thanked God that he lived long enough to see the Führer emerge as the savior of Germany. Others contributed money to the Nazis, but also to other anti-socialist parties on the right. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. Some elements in business were not that hot for fascism. Light industry, which had lower fixed costs and more stable profits than heavy industry that was dependent on consumer buying power and such, the light industrialists were not that keen about a more aggressive foreign policy, about heavy subsidies to heavy industry and the like. But when push came to shove, they may not have been close to the fascists, but they weren't about to ally themselves with the proletariat against the business class of which they were a part. And they pretty much sided with the dominant elements or kept their mouths shut. There was another element in these two societies that not only tolerated the rise of fascism, but supported it. And I'm talking about the parliamentary capitalist state itself. Not the government or the parliament as such, but the instruments of the state. The instruments that have the legal monopoly on force and violence. The police, the army, the courts, and the like. The secret intelligence agencies and such. In both Italy and Germany, years before Mussolini and Hitler emerged victorious, these elements, courts, police, the army, showed a real leniency and an open collaboration with fascism while harshly repressing the left. Mussolini and Hitler could not have come to power without the help of the state machineries. and that state machinery was never really against him. In Italy, the police collaborated with the fascists in attacking labor and peasant organizations. They recruited criminals for the fascist action squads, the squadristi, as they call squadristi. They promised them immunity from prosecution for past crimes. When applications for gun permits were regularly denied to workers and peasants, police guns and police cars were made available to Mussolini's goons. Germany, the same kind of thing went on. Immediately after the war, the military police and the judiciary sided with the rightists to suppress the left, a pattern of collaboration that continued to the day that Hitler took power. In other words, these supposed democracies, which were equally opposed to totalitarianism of the left and the right, were not equally opposed. They were opposed to the left, and they were very close and comfy with the right, because the right